Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I would like to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Yi Lam, one of our graduating resident physicians, soon to be doing her fellowship at UNC Family Medicine, who's filling in for Adam today. Welcome, Yi.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
On our show today, Yi and I will be talking with Dr. Thomas Shea, director of the UNC Bone Marrow and Stem Cell Transplantation Programs, as well as associate director of outreach at UNC's Limeburger Cancer Center, about bone marrow transplantation in the 21st century.
But first, Christy, let's talk about some research that matters.
Yeah, we're going to talk today, Yi, about pesticides and a risk of breast cancer.
And we're going to talk about the decreased rates of precancerous cervical lesions in women who've received the HPV vaccine.
About car crashes and a relationship with sleeping pills.
And then something very relevant for this hot weather is kids not drinking enough water.
All right. Well, let's jump right in with pesticides. So you guys know that DDT, or that pesticide that was so bad, was banned in the United States in 1972, but apparently is still used worldwide in other parts of the world.
A recent study has shown that exposure while inside mom's belly could lead to an increased risk for women subsequently for breast cancer.
So this was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, where these researchers tracked more than 20,000 pregnancies and followed them over time. And what they found, as you're saying, Yi, is that the women who had higher levels of this DDT in their blood during pregnancy or soon after childbirth, as they followed their babies over 54 years, those children had higher risks of developing breast cancer at a young age.
And so something to think about long term is, even though DDT has no longer been used in the U.S., it is still being used across the world, as Christy mentioned. It is something for us to be very careful about and thinking about whether that would be safe for women in the future.
And to advocate for change on the global health scale. Let's talk about something going on right here in our country, and that is the use of the HPV vaccine. And Adam and I have talked about this on the show many times, Yi. And I know you and I have talked about it during your training and in clinical care.
Absolutely.
There is this vaccine now that prevents against cervical cancer. So the virus, human papillomavirus, the HPV vaccine or virus, is the primary driver for cervical cancer development. And by providing this vaccine to children that's now recommended at age 11, the idea is that then prevents cancer.
A study recently published online in the journal Cancer showed that particularly for young women aged 18 to 20 and 21 to 24, there was a decrease in rates of what we call high-grade or precancerous cervical lesions, which over a longer period of time can lead to cervical cancer. And so the study suggests that there's probably some benefit from the HPV vaccine leading to these decreased rates.
And in fact, the screening is no longer recommended for women before age 21 years. So we used to start it for everyone, and it used to be something you had to do every year, and those guidelines have changed. So there may be some muddiness to the data because we're not screening as many people before age 21, but there's great promise in here suggesting that, or just giving some data now to show that there is benefit in providing this HPV vaccine series to young girls before they become sexually active is the ideal situation, and that way that protects them from the virus that causes cancer.
And long term, hopefully we'll find more beneficial data as we continue to follow these women who've received the vaccine.
So next we're going to talk about car crashes and sleeping pills. So, I mean, if you think about, should people be driving while they're on sleeping pills, you would say, of course not. But this is really looking at trying to track a way to link risks of having a car crash with people who take sleeping pills at night.
And so a study in Washington where they monitored 400,000 drivers and what kinds of medications they were taking, including sleeping medications, was published recently in the American Journal of Public Health and did show an increased risk of car accidents for people who had been taking sleep medications. And this risk was almost as high as for people who were driving drunk.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty shocking. They looked at three different medicines, trazodone, temazepam, which is Restoril, and Zolpidem, which is Ambien, very commonly prescribed medication here in the United States, and showed that if you had a prescription for one of those three, your risk of having a car crash was higher. So really impressive that that risk was similar to the crash risk associated with driving drunk, as you're saying, Yi. And I mean, part of this supports the policy change in 2013 that required lower recommended dosing of the Ambien products. So for women, we know now it stays in our bodies longer. And so the recommended dose was cut in half to 5 milligrams from what before was done at 10 milligrams. But really, there is a point here hidden in here that sleeping pills are not the answer, that there it's a more complex issue often, and that other strategies should be used first.
Absolutely. And moving on to the last topic that we have today for research that matters is that U.S. kids are not drinking enough water or staying well hydrated. They found that many children and teens especially aren't drinking enough fluids, especially in this heat in the summer, and this can affect their physical as well as their mental health.
Yeah, this was research published in the American Journal of Public Health, study done at Harvard University, where they looked at 4,000 children and teenagers, ranges in age from 6 to 19, and they had taken part in this United States National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and found that about half the children and teens were not getting enough hydration. And of course, that was more common in boys, 76% higher in boys than in girls. They thought could be sort of linked to not as much emphasis on this during the school day, where access to water might be limited. Some of it perhaps influenced by more juice and other soda and sugary products that are perhaps chosen or packed more commonly in kids.
And they felt a way to help encourage kids to drink more water. Some practical tips for us to try would be to keep the water cold, since kids seem to like cold water a little bit more than warm water, especially in the heat. And so packing a frozen water bottle with a lunchbox could help keep the lunch cold. And then also not to rely on a kid's telling you that they're thirsty. Sometimes that can be a little bit too late, but making sure they have access to drinking water all day long.
That one really caught me, because my son doesn't tell me he's thirsty. And so just really thinking during the heat and during the school day of really thinking about it for him, of making sure that there are those planned times and that you're paying attention at camps or at school, that there are those planned times for your children to drink, not just waiting until they ask.
Mm-hmm. And then the last thing to make that water taste a little bit more tasty is to maybe put some frozen fruit in it. That can help keep it cold and add a little bit of flavor.
I know. Great ideas to get kids to want water. Okay. Well, hopefully that has been some research that matters to you. We've talked about trying to encourage water drinking in our children to prevent from dehydration. We've talked about car crash risk doubling for new users of sleeping pills, something to really pay attention to.
We talked about the HPV vaccine and its possible benefits for women about preventing cervical cancer.
And finally, about pesticides used decades ago may raise breast cancer risk, and something we need to pay attention to worldwide. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Shea, Director of the UNC Bone Marrow and Stem Cell Transplantation Programs and Associate Director of Outreach at UNC's Limeburger Cancer Center, about bone marrow transplantation in the 21st century. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Yi Lam. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Yi Lam, our guest host today. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Shea, director of the UNC Bone Marrow and Stem Cell Transplantation Programs, as well as associate director of outreach at UNC's Limeburger Cancer Center, about bone marrow transplantation in the 21st century. We're so glad to have you with us, Dr. Shea.
Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Definitely welcome, and thank you for being with us today. And we do have a couple of questions, but also just want to hear from you about your story. You've had an amazing career and somehow come full circle back to UNC, and it would be great for us and as well as our listeners to hear a little bit about what that journey has been for you.
Well, it was interesting that when I first left UNC as a medical student, I initially was going to go into family medicine, actually. During the process of looking at residencies and so on, it just didn't seem to quite fit. And I had had some interest based on some earlier travels to maybe work in the third world. So I actually went ahead and arranged for a year to be spent in Nicaragua. And so I was down there in 1978 and 79. And that's sort of relevant because it kind of gets to the idea that I've always been interested really in, in patient care to a large degree, more so than administration or research or some of the other things that I've migrated into over the years. I did spend about a year down there, came back matched by shortwave radio with the UNC internal medicine program, since they knew me. And they said, you can come back over. And so we did that for a little bit.
So you have some experience with radio? Is that right?
Yeah, by shortwave radio. YN4ZAK was my call sign from Puerto Cabeza, Nicaragua. And but anyway, I came back and did my internship. But at that point, I had been at UNC for a long time, both for college and medicine and medical school, rather. And so I decided it was time to branch out and headed up to Boston. 3 or 4 months into my second year as a resident, all of my colleagues at that point were deciding what they wanted to do for fellowship work, and I was doing hematology and oncology, and I really liked looking at microscopes, and I liked the kind of primary care aspects of being a medical oncologist, and liked the slides and liked the hematology part, so kind of stayed in that, and eventually that ended up with me going into bone marrow and stem cell transplants, which is a sort of an end result of a hematology career, I guess. So.
Wow. Well, we're certainly glad that you did. And I wonder, do our listeners, we need to do some translation, I think, about what exactly is. People know what bone marrow is and you hear about stem cells, but let's really break it down. Well, we have our health sciences librarians who are fantastic, who will put up some pictures and descriptions on our blog. But would love to have you explain to us in the plainest language that you can, what exactly is bone marrow and what are stem cells?
Well, the bone marrow is the part of the body where your blood comes from, and initially also where your immune cells start. So, it's not only the part of the body where red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets are made, and platelets clot the blood, and red blood cells carry oxygen around to the various organs, which you obviously need, and then the white cells are the primary infection fighting cells in your body, those cells are made in the marrow, which are basically sort of a cavity within the skeleton. And I liken it a little bit to a building. You can look at the outside, but you don't know what goes on the inside. And what goes on the inside may not have much to do with what the appearances are on the outside. So the marrow and the skeleton are really kind of different. They're just sort of two parts of the same coin, if you will. One of the wonderful things about all the organs in the body is what we call there is sort of a stem cell component to them, in that organs have to be able to live for the entire life of the person. And so if you didn't have cells that were capable of over time making their own duplicate cells, then you'd end up losing liver function or heart function or lung function or bone marrow function. And in the case of the bone marrow, the cells that are responsible for the long-term generation of more blood cells down the road are what we call the stem cells. And so, the analogy is that's kind of the stem or the trunk of a tree, and the tree are the end results that circulate in your blood and so on. In the field of transplantation, we know that those cells that live in the bone marrow also float around at a very small level in the bloodstream. And so what's happened over the last 15 or 20 years is that while we still talk about bone marrow transplants, in many ways these are blood stem cells that are now floating around in the body. And so we don't have to usually collect them from the bone marrow anymore, mm-hmm. from inside the bone, but we actually have ways to get them to move out of the marrow and float around in the bloodstream. And so you can collect them, whether it's from a person to put back into the same individual. That's called an autologous transplant. Or if you're trying to get the cells from one person to another, that would be a donor or allogeneic transplant. And in either case, you can usually get the cells out of the bloodstream and then put them back in, and they find their way back into the bone marrow and sort of grow and do what they need to do.
Now, give us a sense of what the most common scenarios are for patients who might need a transplantation of bone marrow or stem cells.
Yeah, so people also talk about these stem cells being, they kind of confuse it a little bit with what we would call embryonic stem cells, or the whole idea of, you know, stem cells, that's how you take an embryo and you can turn it into a brain or turn it into mm-hmm. a liver or whatever. These are really cells that are, for the most part, kind of just dedicated to making more blood cells and more immune cells, but they don't generally go to make other organs other than recreate the marrow cells. Now, as an aside, you actually can play with some of these very primitive cells in the blood, and you can get them to morphologically change into some of these other tissues, but that's really not kind of the embryonic stem cell piece. What we do in my field is primarily use this as a way to allow us to give patients either very high doses of chemotherapy or radiation or other sorts of treatments that are designed to get rid of whatever cancer they have. The commonest indication is actually multiple myeloma in terms of the number of people that we would tend to treat with this approach. But in the process of wiping out most of the cancer, you also wipe out most of the normal blood cells or bone marrow cells that they have. So you either have to get healthy cells from a donor to put into the recipient, or in many cases, you can actually collect blood cells ahead of time, freeze them, then treat the patient with the chemotherapy or radiation or whatever you're going to do, and then put back in their own cells. And that allows you to get rid of most of the malignancy and kind of jumpstart the marrow and the immune system by putting back in the cells that you had taken out before.
So. That is amazing.
And this is something you even mentioned, that a lot of this has changed over the course of your career through some of the work that you've done in collaboration with others. And for some of our listeners, I think some of them may have ideas of it used to be that donors were certain people in the family or mm-hmm. from themselves. So is there something now that's, you mentioned kind of taking cells from yourself or a donor, does a donor have to be related to a patient now?
Yeah, I think that one of the big one of the huge changes over the last 20 years has been maybe two huge changes, I guess I'll say. The first is that when I started, we really weren't using what we call these peripheral blood stem cells. All of the marrow cells that we got were actually from the bone marrow. And so the way you had to collect those, whether it was from the patient or from a donor, was take them to the operating room and take out about a quart of bone marrow from their hip bones. That's where most of the marrow is in an adult. That wasn't a huge inconvenience, but it certainly wasn't pleasant, and it was an operating procedure, and people were left with pretty sore, you know, hips and backsides for a few days afterwards, and so it was a big deal. With the availability of using or getting cells from the blood, that process is much easier. So that was one, I think, substantive change that we've seen over the 20 years. I think the other thing that has changed dramatically is that in our ability to identify if you're going to do a donor transplant, who's a good donor and who's not a good donor. And if you try to stay within the family, as you alluded to in the past, only about one in four siblings would be a perfect match for you. And that's not a very good match in general. That's not really a good enough match for you to safely be able to take people on. So the other huge change during this time has been that there are now almost 20 million people in a registry of potential bone marrow donors or stem cell donors from around the world who are able and willing to donate cells for somebody who needs a transplant for leukemia or for aplastic anemia or for lymphoma, but who doesn't have a sibling that is a match with them. And so with all of these extra people out there that are willing to donate, depending on the race of the patient, and I say that because Caucasians have about an 80% to 90% chance of being able to find a good recipient or a good donor, rather, in the registry. But if you're African American, that's only about 55% or 60%, and if you're Hispanic or Asian, it's even less than that. It's about 50-50. So that registry has been a huge plus for donor transplants, but it still leaves us with a significant percentage of people that can't find donors. And so for that, we're actually now looking at alternatives, what we call alternative donors, which is a new field that I think over the last 5 years has really started to take hold as well.
Well, we do want to talk about that donor registry and maybe how to stimulate people to get involved. But first, we need to take a short break, and we'll continue this conversation with our guest, Dr. Thomas Shea, director of the UNC Bone Marrow and Stem Cell Transplantation Programs, about bone marrow transplantation in the 21st century. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest host, Dr. Yi Lam. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest co-host, Dr. Yi Lam. We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Shea, director of the UNC Bone Marrow and Stem Cell Transplantation Programs, and he's also the associate director of outreach at UNC's Limeburger Cancer Center, about bone marrow transplantation in the 21st century. And before the break, in our first part of this conversation, Dr. Shea, you were telling us about just the amazing technology and ability that we have now, which is life-saving for many cancer patients, where you're able to collect, in some instances, bone marrow, save it for when people need it during their cancer treatment, and then be able to provide them the right cells to help them regenerate and recover more quickly, and in many cases be able to live and survive. What a gift. And we talked a little bit about donation and what it means to be a donor and how to do that. Tell us a little bit about where we're headed with stem cell donation.
Sure. Well, I think the donation process, I'll just mention briefly, is there is a large database. It's an international database of people who are potentially interested in being donors. The only issue with that is it is very much based on, if you will, the availability of the donors really depends a lot on what the ethnic composition of the patient is in terms of their likelihood of finding a good donor or not. So we continue to need more donors through the process. And, you know, the donation process is pretty straightforward. It basically is collecting and sort of filtering blood. You take the cells out, you put the blood back in, and so it all takes about 3 or 4 hours as an outpatient. And it's a pretty simple process for the donors. And it used to be that they only would allow donors to donate once, but the donors found it so gratifying that they kind of forced the program to basically allow them to donate more than once. So now there's a limit on the interval of time between when you can donate the first time and the second time, but people have donated more than one time through this process because they find it so rewarding.
And so it's not the same as just – it's similar to the process of giving your blood to the Red Cross, but it's a different place, a different process. You have to indicate that you're giving it for this purpose.
That's right. I mean, and it's all done anonymously. So, if we find a potential donor in the computer list, we say, bring in these donors, and then they could be in St. Louis, they could be in Spokane, Washington, they could be in Paris, France. We don't know where they're from. But then they get the donor in, and if the donor turns out to be as good a match as we hope, then the way they collect the cells is usually a few days' worth of injections of a drug called GCSF, which are like insulin shots, if you will. It boosts the blood counts up. and then they collect the cells from the donor at the site that the donor lives, so the donor doesn't have to travel, and they're collected just the same way that if you were to go to the Red Cross to donate platelets. They're sort of spun in a centrifuge, and then the patient gets back or the donor gets back their blood, but we hold on to the white blood cells that have the stem cells in them, and then they ship the stem cells to wherever the patient is.
Wow.
And so that's the way the process works.
That's amazing.
But even with all of that and with that process being much simpler than the operating room and so on, there are still a lot of people, particularly minorities, who are left without having a good donor through this registry, or they don't have siblings who are a match, whatever. And so that really kind of brings us to a new area of the field where what we call alternative donors, and people are looking for potential donors either using cells from umbilical cord blood, products, or what we call haploidentical. And that term is kind of a technical term, but it basically means a 50-50 match. And most people, if you have any living children who are healthy, they would be a 50% match with the parent. Mm-hmm. If you have a young person and their parents are still living, they'll usually have a 50% match with both of their parents, actually. Mm-hmm. And so that, if you can use those kinds of cells, that automatically expands the potential donor pool a whole lot. And an example of that was a recent patient that we had who is a 60-ish-year-old woman with who's African-American and had acute myeloid leukemia. She did not have any matches either in her family or in the registry, but was able to use a 50% match of one of her children as her donor. And she's now about 6 months out from her transplant and is doing
wow.
great and in remission and, keeping our fingers crossed. But hopefully she'll continue to what basically is at this point leading a pretty normal life.
And so in the past, she would have been in real trouble not having any sort of a match. But now, because of new technology and advances, her child is able to save her, sounds
That's
like.
Right.
That's
right.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
And it sounds like through this kind of medicine, you really establish a bond with not only the patient, but at times, in this case particularly, with the family.
Yeah.
How do you balance all of that in doing the research and the teaching with really still getting to engage with patients and their families?
There are a bunch of questions in there, so I don't know how I balance it all. I think that part of it is that the process itself, it is a complicated process, and it really is the essence of you get to do primary care because you really are sort of on the front lines with these folks, but you have to have a pretty big team, and the big team has to provide not only portions of the care and social workers and nurses and coordinators and physician assistants and, the whole inpatient group. But then on top of that is the research that you do at the same time, some of which is laboratory-based research, and we have several faculty who have very productive and prolific laboratory careers looking at the immune reactions between the donor and the host and how to get them to work well and not cause trouble, because you can imagine it's sort of the ultimate allergic reaction between, a patient and a whole new immune system that they have to get used to. And so that's kind of the term we call that is graft versus host disease, and that's a big part of what we spend our time trying to treat. But then you also have to have clinical trials, which is what I spend most of my time doing, and that is enrolling people on studies to try to figure out whether or not, the laboratory breakthroughs that we come up with are really effective and how effective they are and do they take the place of the standard treatments that we offer. So I think that for me, having a team and being able to share the good and the bad with not only the patients but also with the rest of the group is pretty critical to being able to continue to kind of keep doing this day in and day out and year in and year out like we've been able to do.
Well, we are grateful that you've been able to stay committed to your patients and committed to families as you're driving forward and pushing the envelope in stem cell transplantation for bone marrow and stem cell transplants. What is next? What's next on the horizon as we're concluding? What do we have to look forward to in the future, mm-hmm. or what would be your dream?
Well, probably the hottest new area for us at this point is, sometimes we're looking at transplanting new diseases. And so things like sickle cell disease are areas that we're, you know, centers are focusing on. And, you know, there are some very positive outcomes there, although there's a history where some of those transplants have not gone as well as we would have liked. So I think that's an area that's still in flux. But new areas is one. And then the other big part of what we do is even though we try very hard to get the immune system to work well, whenever you're mixing two immune systems, there's always going to be a risk of major problems like I was alluding to before. So in many ways, our ultimate research is to do away with transplantation and try to find other ways to make the immune system smarter and coach it to do what it needs to do to control the cancer without getting cells from another person. So
fantastic.
That whole area of what we call immunotherapy is where we and other centers are really kind of pushing forward now.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for continuing to push the envelope. Thank you for taking time with us today and sharing with our listeners. We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Shea, director of the UNC Bone Marrow and Stem Cell Transplantation Program, about bone marrow transplantation in the 21st century. We need to take a break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Yi Lam. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Yi and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We have a couple great ones to address today about chronic pain, grief, strep throat, and blood pressure.
And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first House Call question. Erica?
I've had chronic pain for over 3 decades. In the past, my doctors were unwilling to give me opiates as they thought I was faking it and was concerned I'd become addicted. I even wondered if it was because I was African American and that I got a different care than what others might have received. I have a new doctor now, and he did an MRI that showed that I had multiple collapsed discs, which accounted for my chronic pain. He started me on opiates after other doctors refused, and for the first time in my adult life, my pain is tolerable. I hope my story is useful for others.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. I'm sorry to hear that you felt not listened to or not trusted and that you didn't feel that you got the same care as other people. That is not the way that we want to take care of people as physicians and providers and care teams. You starting opioids or these narcotic medications is not the first thing to do because there are a lot of dangers and risks that go along with it. But it does sound like this has been really helpful for you, and I'm glad to hear that it's been what sounds like it's been a success story now that you're able to tolerate your pain.
And it sounds like you've done an amazing job advocating for yourself and for your health. And that's something that will serve you well as you continue to recover.
Let's take our next house call, Erica.
Last year, my best friend of over 20 years went through a very painful death. I was with her every single day for the last 4 months of her life. I know I did the best I could, and I have no regrets. But I am having difficulty accepting her death. Even 6 months later, I can't seem to cope. Is this normal?
I'm so sorry for your loss, and it sounds like you did get to spend some very good time with your friend, which is wonderful. Normal is different for everyone in the grieving process, and there's no clear time frame for when we would say that you should be able to feel like you can cope. But there are a lot of resources out there for you.
Thank you for sharing the story and for recognizing that. You know, you're asking these questions. Is this normal? This is still hard. And I agree with you, Yi, that there is no normal. But yet, most people need support. We all need support in this life. And the grieving process can be very painful and very challenging. And so it's important to pursue counseling, which you could do individually. There's grief counseling, or there's also other forms of counseling that could be helpful as you're moving forward in life. There's group support and grieving support groups in the community. And I encourage you to talk with your primary care doctor about how to access those resources and whether there may be other things going on with your own health or potentially with depression that could be playing a role here. So it's important to explore that and talk with your doctor about that. And we wish you all the best.
Absolutely. And for our next question, Erica?
I'm on 3 blood pressure medications and my BP is still too high. I've accepted the fact that I'm really overweight and I don't follow a specific diet, nor am I physically active. My doctor hesitantly added a fourth blood pressure medication, which I don't want to take either. I'm not sure what to do and would appreciate your thoughts.
Nobody wants to take those medicines. And part of it is, you know, a lot of times you don't feel bad with high blood pressure. Some people say, oh, I feel headaches or I can tell when my blood pressure is high. But a lot of people just don't feel that bad when their blood pressure is too high. And yet the blood pressure is causing damage to your heart and your kidneys and your blood vessels throughout your body. And so, I mean, it sounds like you don't want to take the extra medicine. Your doctor wasn't thrilled to add another one either. But my initial take, I'll be interested in what you think, E. My initial take is to take the medicines. Take the medicines now while you are treating this as a very big wake-up call to really work and commit your effort, your full effort to losing weight. And that's diet, that's exercise. Sometimes that involves surgery, depending on what else is going on with your health. But I would take this very seriously to do the medicine and do what really matters is that lifestyle change.
And I agree with Christy. I think a big part of this is it's hard to take medications. It's even harder to make other changes in your life. But long term, the things that you're trying to prevent are things that are going to make life even harder, like heart attacks and strokes and other complications from your weight and not following the diet that it seems like you'd like to try and get going. So taking blood pressure medicine sometimes can give you that time to get yourself organized in other ways to make these other changes in your life that hopefully will continue to make positive changes just to prevent some other things down the line.
Thank you for sharing that, and we wish you all the best as you move forward towards a healthier life. Let's take our last house call question. Erica?
My daughter is 17 and had 5 episodes of throat infections each year for the last 5 years. Our family doctor suggested that my daughter have her tonsils removed. I know this was done in the past, but I didn't think this was common practice anymore. Won't she just grow out of this? We, of course, want to do what's best for our overall health, and I would appreciate your thoughts.
Five strep throat infections in each year for 5 years, or it says throat infection, so maybe it's not all strep throat. But that sounds like a lot, especially if they were like documented strep throat infections. 5 in a year for 5 years kind of sounds like a lot.
And actually, there are guidelines talking about how many strep throat infections per year is really an indication or a recommendation to have the tonsils out. And that's about 6. So, you know, over the course of 5 years, having 5, I think it's definitely a good idea to have this conversation with your doctor. Recommendations right now are really just to have that conversation and really talk about the risks and the benefits of doing a procedure. But I think at this point, it would be a good idea.
Yeah, and you know, you can go and have an appointment with an ear, nose, and throat doctor, which is the kind of specialist, an ENT, that does that kind of surgery. And you know, often your family doctor will know a trusted person to send you to, or send you and your daughter to talk about the risks and benefits, and someone who wouldn't necessarily do the surgery if it's not in the best interest of your child. But to have those conversations with the person who would be doing the procedure is usually the person who can guide you along with your family doctor to make the decision that's in the best interest of your daughter. Thank you for your house call question. And thanks to everybody for sharing questions today. We've had some good ones, Yi, about chronic pain and medicines to help that.
As well as strep throat.
And about the grieving process and importance of using the resources to help you through it.
And about dealing with blood pressure, which is multiple things to help with one major problem.
Yeah, thanks everyone for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. And we want you to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, iTunes, and our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship and our guest today, Dr. Thomas Shea. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Yi Lam.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.